Hello, and welcome again to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA's Convergent Aeronautic Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As aerospace operations become increasingly complex and autonomous, success depends not only on advanced technologies, but on the integrated data and reasoning systems that enable intelligent decision-making across diverse stakeholders. Traditional approaches that treat computational resources, human expertise, and organizational knowledge as separate components are often insufficient for the interconnected challenges of modern aerospace operations. Today, we're going to explore how data and reasoning fabrics can create unified intelligence architectures that span government, industry, and academia. We'll examine how decades of NASA's intelligence systems and computational leadership can inform new models of cross-sector collaboration and how academic partnerships can accelerate the translation of advanced research into operational aerospace capabilities. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshimworks, and joined today by William Van Dalsum, retired NASA Ames veteran with 42 years of aerospace leadership experience, now adjunct lecturer at Stanford University and advisor to aerospace technology companies. Bill, welcome. Thrilled to have you join us today. I'm really excited about the conversation and grateful for your time and perspective here. So maybe let's get started with a little bit of a background on yourself, and then we can just dive into the conversation.
Oh, thank you. First of all, great introduction already. I guess the only things I might add is I got my undergraduate degree at UC Santa Barbara, and my capstone project was a diffuser augmented wind turbine. So I've always been interested in green energy, for example. I moved to NASA right after that. And at the same time, I started my master's and PhD at Stanford. So I've actually been sort of affiliated with Stanford even longer than I've been affiliated with NASA because I got there first. Let's see. Since retiring, I've done a lot of work. I really have enjoyed being able to work with the students out at Stanford, and I'm running the part of the teaching team for the capstone program, but I also mentor a lot of students across the university, and it's just really enjoyable. And I also do a little bit of focused work on wildfire, in part because my hometown was Paradise, California, which burnt down. So I've done a lot of work in that area specifically.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And also excited to hear some of the work that you've done with entrepreneurs as well. But California has seen such dramatic kind of volatility in the environmental kind of challenges that it's faced. And technology has evolved to the point where we're able to unlock some really effective solutions using a lot of the space and Earth observation technology. So I'm looking forward to getting into that as well. But I'm sorry about what you and your community had to go through there in Paradise. And I'm hoping that with the advanced applications of these technologies and methodologies, we'll see less and less of that kind of impact in the decades to come. But maybe let's jump in. You have, really looking back through your amazing career, you've led really everything from, 200 million NASA spanning programs to organizations of hundreds of researchers. And now you, as you mentioned, you're teaching at Stanford while advising aerospace companies. What are some of the patterns that you've observed about how the successful aerospace systems integrate with technical capabilities, organizational knowledge, and cross-sector partnerships? We're seeing such a dramatic influx of new technologies and innovations and new operating models within markets. What are some of the patterns that you've observed in the work that you've done in NASA and the university?
Regarding being successful, the thing I've noticed is that if the organization, be it a line organization or a project or a program or some sort of collaborative activity, it's really important to identify the objective and to have everybody agree on what we're trying to do. That sounds pretty simple, but I've actually been in some projects where that wasn't well defined. Maybe, you get in there a year or so and you kind of look back at each other and you go, hey, what exactly are we working on here? So that's sort of the first thing, is to have everybody, you know, really get together and really write down, you know, definitively what it is we're trying to accomplish. And that isn't always easy, especially, for example, if a line organization is changing what it wants to do from what it has done historically, or trying to take advantage of new innovations or technical. So it's not an easy first step, but I don't think you can do much without it. The other thing I've sort of noticed over the years is, and this comes out very frequently when we negotiate the capstone projects at Stanford, because we negotiate on the order of probably about 20 or 25 a year with, you know, NASA, Boeing, all kinds of international organizations, is you have to be very careful to keep what it is you want to accomplish different from how it's accomplished. And it can be very dangerous. It can be very constraining if you include the how with the what. And a classic example I maybe would be, let's say you want to go land on another planet. And you say, well, you make your statement that, well, we're going to fire our retro rockets and land on Mars. All right. Well, you've already solved the problem. You know, you can't fly in. You can't pull parachutes. You can't bounce around like a ball. You know, so separating the how from the what is extremely important, is sort of a second thing. So those two things I would maybe need to observe.
Those are great points, and very, very consistent with what we see in ecosystem design and innovation system design, right? You don't want to necessarily over constrain the team and the creativity. You know, fix on, you know, clear definition of problem and outcomes, and let the team work their magic. So that makes sense. Are you seeing a big kind of shift in the methodologies or the capabilities that the students are able to utilize, just given the incredible new technologies that are becoming available? In AI is top of mind for everyone, right? So it tends to unlock a lot more potential, but also risk. Is that informing the creative process for your students more these days? And what are the risks associated with that?
I've actually been working on a lecture on just this topic, so I'll keep it short. But for example, the LLMs are amazing. They do amazing things. And I'll just make a general statement that artificial intelligence and engineering, there's sort of two ways they can interact. One is they can help with the engineering processes, for example, defining your requirements, brainstorming, constraining things down, and they can actually be exploited in the system. So you can have a neural net, you know, identifying whether or not the thing on the runway is a, you know, a car or a tumbleweed. So more to the first point of using these things in engineering processes, yes, they're amazing tools, but there's a lot of things they can do wrong. And maybe this will change in a year or two. But they can, there's like four or five things they can do wrong. I mean, one of the ones that they do tend to do is hallucinate. I mean, they just literally go off and, you know, they create references and, you know, they just, you know, kind of do crazy things. And if the students don't do, for example, a back of the envelope or a computational physics analysis sort of separate from the LLM, they can just go off into a very funny land. Another thing is they're not particularly good at context. So an example, I've been asked to give some examples for in class of, you know, how an AI or an LLM could maybe assume a context. So a simple example is if I say, I release an apple, what does it do? An LLM will say it will accelerate at 9.8 meters squared per second. And I'm like, okay, what if it's on a desk? Oh, it won't. What if it's spinning? Oh, it will slow down. What if it's anywhere in the universe? Oh, well, it's probably not going to accelerate because it's not going to be in a gravitational field. So the default answer is wrong 99.9999% of the time. But see, that's where they have lots of context. And then maybe a third thing I'd mention is they can actually harm group dynamics. I'm starting to see that, you know, if there's one person that's the LLM master, you know, and they're off, you know, working with their LLM partner and not the rest of the team, that can actually be somewhat challenging. And I guess a fourth one is quite often the data that they're trained on is historical data. So if you were to train an LLM on what's the best kind of car in the 1950s, and you train it on what's the best kind of car today, they would be different answers. So they have implicit history in them that can sometimes be constraining. So anyway, they're wonderful tools, but you just got to be careful with them.
Right. It's understanding, how and where and to what degree you can apply those tools is going to be the trick for students and professionals, really, as these resources become more embedded in the way we work and interact. You've done a lot of work. I've been fascinated. When you and I first chatted, we talked briefly about the data and reasoning fabric that you worked on for quite some time during your time at NASA. So for our listeners, your work on the data and reasoning fabric, or the DRF, represents really a novel approach to enabling a lot of things, but enabling advanced air mobility through integrated data and reasoning systems. So what was the thought process to kind of move past traditional siloed approaches to data and decision-making and really start to embrace something that would better support the complexity of modern aerospace operations? Presumably there are many use cases that could be helpful for as well.
Well, just to give some acknowledgement, I had a lot of different jobs in my career, and I probably spent about a little over a third of my time in aeronautics, a third in space, and a third in advanced IT systems. And so when I came back into aeronautics, I'd already spent something on the order of 5 years running the Intelligent Systems Division at NASA Ames, which is, I think, the largest intelligent systems organization within NASA. And the experts over there used to say, Bill, you don't really know what you're doing. So, and they would take me out into the hallway, and we'd sit there for literally on the floor sometimes for a couple of hours while they teached me things. And so I learned an awful lot by just being receptive to those hundreds of, experts in data systems and artificial intelligence. So I just want to acknowledge that. And then I went back into aeronautics. And as we know, NASA Ames is focused a bit on the air traffic management part of that. And I watched that for quite a few years. And what I sort of noted was that the data systems were mainly being designed by aerospace engineers. Okay, they can do a pretty good job. But then I kept thinking back to the people that had me on the floors and the hallways for 3 hours telling me how artificial intelligence is supposed to work and data systems. And I was like, well, I think there's another community out there that could really help with this, because we're getting into a very, very complicated data environment. And to be more specific, if you look at the way typical, commercial aircraft are managed, it's usually managed with a limited amount of data going into a control tower. And then a mission the operators, the air traffic control operators, will decide where the airplanes are going to go. And then off they go. And then they'll call back. Sometimes there's been some work, ATD-3, trying to include, for example, the impacts of convective weather events like hurricanes or clouds or whatever, and moving and flying around things like that. But to first order, it's a lot of, aggregating data in a control tower, and a FAA operator tells the airplanes where to go. Well, if you think about trying to operate, say, 1,000 drones in a downtown urban setting, and these drones, and maybe they're eVTOLs, they want to pick up people that have just arrived from a light rail station, or they're trying to pick up packages that may or may not have been delivered, and they need to be delivered to some other location, and they need to operate in this very, very complicated urban environment, with the big commercial airplanes flying over, some helicopters flying by, some eVTOLs, some UAVs. You don't pre-design that trajectory, frankly, I don't think. I really think you need to move you can come up with a predefined trajectory, you should fly from point A to point B in this path. But generally speaking, that thing has to evolve in the real time, I think. And so what does that mean? That means, first of all, if you have 1,000 drones, how many operators do you have? 1,000? 100? 10? Oh, So clearly that doesn't scale. You can't have one operator per 1,000 drones. It's just too expensive. So you got to move a lot of the intelligence into autonomous operations, and a lot of data needs to exist. I'll say it's at the edge or in the vehicle. And the strong point there is, and I learned this working with some earth scientists, is the spacecraft that are going around our planet, they can collect far more data than they can download. Generally, it's something on the order of an order of magnitude difference. Well, so these drones have 4K cameras and LiDAR, and you can't take all that data and ship it off to a cloud to make a decision on it. You have to make decisions in the vehicle. You know, like, what is that thing in front of me? Is that a tree or is that a building wall? So first of all, there's a lot more data. It's a lot more dynamic. It really needs to live on the edge, and we need to be able to decide, make decisions on that edge in those vehicles. And the data needs to include not only the sort of situational awareness stuff, like there's a drone in front of me or a bird or whatever, but it also needs to have situational awareness. Where's my passenger? Oh, my passenger got stuck at home. Oh, well, I'm not going to go pick them up. I'll go do something else. Or the packages. So it's just a much, much, much more heterogeneous and complicated and dynamic environment. And this sort of edge decision-making, I think, is essential. So, sorry, it's a long answer, but I spent a long time thinking about it. And I guess I'm a little crazy, but I just think it's different.
No, you're absolutely right. And listening to you, Bill, I'm thinking about the work that we did while I was at GE. So I was part of the digital transformation team at GE. Yep. The industrial internet was just really coming into its own. But I was doing some work in basically connected vehicles. And so where the vehicles themselves became kind of almost a data repository and a lightweight kind of processing node. It was very early days, but all of these capabilities of establishing a fleet of intelligent and autonomous equipment, right? Well, we can call it equipment because whether it's industrial equipment or fleet vehicles or UAVs, right? You need to have that, you know, those protocols for the autonomous decision making. And that requires a tremendous amount of kind of training and simulation data. Where are we in that evolution? Are we kind of getting to the point where we have the confidence in the autonomy functions, or do we still need to evolve that capability? In your opinion?
My opinion. NASA Ames was very fortunate. We did a little bit of work with Google when they were first developing their autonomous vehicles, and we got to hear a lot about what they were doing to begin with, because they were actually testing there at Ames. And one of the things that I found very compelling is, you know, they would basically collect data to go to the moon and back. They had that much data that they would train their autonomous systems with. They explained that to us. And that's great. And so you can maybe capture 98% of what might happen if you drive 250,000 miles a night, but you won't capture it all. And the systems will get confused. Okay. And then another thing that's been explained to me by people that are a lot smarter than I am, for example, the people at IHMC, is that the LLMs and artificial intelligence in general doesn't have a model of the physical world. And so if you or I are driving a car and we see a ball bouncing across the street, we might think, let's see, that's a pretty ball. I wonder if there's a small child that's going to come and try to get it. So we have mental models of how the world works, and I'm not quite sure that the LLMs have that. And so if they encounter something that they haven't been trained on and they don't have a model of the physical world, that combination tends to lead them to being confused. So when they get confused, they have to be able to phone home. I mean, I don't know how else to put it, but they have to be able to phone home and say, hey, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what to do. Please help me.
Yeah, just based on the work that we were doing at GE and in talking to a lot of folks, I don't see the full autonomy really becoming mainstream for quite some time. It just, we need that steady and guiding hand for those exception or, you know, questionable types of events. So maybe if we look at your work at Stanford, you're actually doing a lot of work with student teams, as you've mentioned, on projects that scan academia, industry, and government organizations like NASA, like Boeing, as you mentioned. It seems that there is exciting work being done in all those domains, and that the collaboration across industry, academia, and government is necessary to leverage the capabilities, the innovation and learnings of all sectors. What, in your mind, how does the collaboration model, how does that need to evolve? And what does that reveal about how the complex aerospace systems should be developed and deployed? What are your thoughts regarding kind of the new model of collaboration across academia and government and industry?
I don't know if it's new. Believe it or not, I was many, many, many years ago, NASA put out a request for proposals for NASA to work with academia and industry. And so I actually led the development of a collaborative effort between Stanford and McDonnell Douglas. And we got funded and we worked together. So, and obviously this has been going on for decades, but I'm just talking from my own personal experience. This has been going on for a while. If you're asking kind of what roles the different kinds of organizations could play, I have a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so NASA really is a mission-oriented organization, for example. They're trying to do things. We want to go look at the caves on, you know, Mars or something, or the moon. They have a very specific thing they're trying to get done. And granted, they have many, many, many experts, many world-class experts in a lot of the stuff that they want to do. Okay, so that's kind of the government thing. Industry, they tend to be developing, the way they're successful is they develop the next generation of technologies. Okay, they already got something in that they're selling, but what's the next thing? And, you know, quite often they have a beachhead customer in mind, but they're not always aware of all the things that their application, their technology could be applied to. Okay, and then academia, first of all, the faculty and research staff, they're amazing. I mean, they have some really in-depth and fundamental capabilities. Like one of them out at Stanford is trying to understand why ice is slippery. That's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure we know the answer to it. So they're kind of evolving on that. And then you have the next generation of engineers available, the students. So I think in particular, if NASA is going to do something that can already be done, mostly, they don't really need anybody. But if they need something that's, say, industrially available, well, then they can go, you know, write a subcontract to a company like Ball Aerospace to develop Kepler, for example. If they need something that is emergent from what's coming out of industry or coming out of the things that are in the minds of the, you know, people, the professors at Stanford, then they need to bring the whole collaboration together. And, you know, one of the things I sort of got mentored on over the decades was the more diverse your team is, probably the better answer you're going to arrive at. And so I guess what I would say is that if we're trying to do something really hard, we should get as much diversity as we possibly can. And I sort of tried to describe the kind of diversity you have when you include those three members of the, I'll say, the research community. I think it's really a positive interaction.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think the diversity helps you really pressure test your assumptions, right? And make sure that you're not overly restricting the possibilities and implications of what you're trying to solve for. So is this the triad model that we've talked about in the past, the relationship, the collaboration between industry, academia, and the agencies?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking about. And it's been somewhat interesting for me. I mean, I spent, 40 some odd years at NASA, and I thought I kind of understood the world. But come to find out, just the few years that I've been out, I realize I didn't. I've learned a lot about the way academia works, and I'm also working directly, with a number of people that are old friends that are, immersed in industry in ways that you probably can't talk to them if you're working for the U.S. government. And I'm learning that the world is a lot more diverse than I possibly thought of as a NASA civil servant. And that's fine. It's just I've learned a lot. So it was educational for me personally.
Yeah. No, that's the minute you stop learning is the minute that, the world gets very boring. But there's so much change, and we're seeing market models evolve, business and economic models evolve. And we've seen over the past few years, I think a refreshed opportunity to maybe enhance the level of collaboration between industry, academia, and agencies. And I just think this is a really exciting time. If we maybe take a look at your advisory work, what you mentioned doing some work that seemed to be entrepreneurs and industry. Kaylin, you talked about Kaylin Space, where they're creating a comprehensive e-commerce marketplace for space services. The growing space economy is just super exciting. How do you see that space industry ecosystem evolving beyond traditional prime contractor models? I have a lot of ideas on this, but I'd love your perspective on this.
Okay. I think, so my son is a very serious electrical engineer, so I learned a lot from him. But one of the things we somewhat recently did is we developed sort of a top-end gaming computer. So what did we do? We went out and picked a CPU, we picked a GPU, we picked a motherboard, we picked a power supply, we picked our RAM, we picked our memory, the storage device, SSD device, and we got a case. And we put them all together, and we have a state-of-the-art, high-performance, extremely effective platform sitting out there that we built from parts. And a lot of that is based on the fact that there's a lot of standards. Oh, well, the GPU plugs in here and the CPU plugs in here, and they have this common backbone standard for how they'll communicate. What an interesting way to build a spacecraft. What if you could go and pick your reaction wheel? Oh, I'm going to pick a structure. Oh, I'm going to pick my propulsion system. Oh, I'm going to pick my whatever, my sensor system. And what if you could put them together like, gaming people put together state-of-the-art computers that they're not quite supercomputers, but they're about as close as you can get, living in a home. They're quite impressive machines. So it's not an entirely bad, maybe, analogy to consider, I would suggest. And I will observe that I've been doing a lot of work lately on UAVs, and that world is kind of going that way. I'll provide that suggestion. There's a lot of standardization of the telemetry, the control systems, the onboard CPUs and things. So there's a lot of plug and play starting to evolve in the UAV world, which is really powerful.
I love the analogy. We find that organizations that are looking for a much more effective way to really create resilience within networks operating systems, right? Within their market environments, which are much more dynamic than they're more dynamic than they ever have been. If they think about, to your point, configuring for interoperability and a module, then that will give them greater freedom to design as new innovations come online, new potential collaborators come online. It's just that kind of systems design that he thinks in terms of connectivity, interoperability, and modularity, and will allow you to kind of change out capability configurations much more dynamically as market needs and conditions evolve. So I love that example. If we think about distributed systems, we spent a lot of time talking about distributed systems in this series. Your career has spanned the evolution from early supercomputing to modern distributed systems and AI and LLM. How do some of the advances in computational capability change what is now possible for organizations in terms of collaborative decision-making and knowledge management, and maybe autonomous decision-making at the edge, as we previously discussed?
So are you asking about how it affects the design process or how it affects the systems, the aerospace vehicle systems?
Yeah, more the operating systems as enabled by the technology systems, right? We can envision that decision making is more enabled at the edge with the distributed technologies, right? The interconnectivity that now underpins most of the organizations and market systems. But just in the arc of your career, what are some of the more powerful unlocks that you've seen for organizations, for market systems based on the new capabilities and technological capabilities?
Well, maybe just to provide some context, we had a pretty active, over the decades, we've had very active discussions as new space systems are being developed. And when sometimes we've walked into these situations and honestly, NASA Ames is really an advocate of this, generally speaking, which is, you know, we need systems that understand themselves. And sometimes we'll walk into an environment historically where people will say, well, does that add any lines of code? And we'll say, well, yeah. And they'll say, well, lines of code cost $150 a line. I don't want to buy any more lines of code. So no. And so we've actually encountered that historically. And I think that's kind of going away. But the problem with that whole basic approach to things is if you go back, I went to an automotive museum recently. And if you go back and look at a Model T, amazing car, very mechanical system. Okay, so now let's say you want to turn that into a car that can monitor its own health. Oh, what's your fuel to air ratio? Oh, are you what's the torque on your clutch? Are you going to exceed your clutch performance? Oh, is your clutch failing? Do you have vibration problems? Going in and retroactively, you know, putting sensors into that Model T is not really feasible. So you really need to think about what it is, how are you going to maintain an awareness of the health of your system? And then, frankly, you need to sensor it up. You need to put a bunch of systems in there. And then you need to develop, I think, more and more, as we've previously discussed, the ability to look at that data in real time in the vehicle and say, hey, you know, my transmission is starting to fail. I need to go land. Or, gee, my combustor in my third engine seems to be burning a little bit hotter than normal. And literally, these are not fake examples. These are real examples that I remember we worked on in Intelligent Systems Vision. So I think that's the kind of thing that needs to happen. We need to think about systems being sort of self-aware from the beginning, and they need to be sensored up. And then you need to be able to put the ability to deal with much of that data on the system itself. And then in addition, as we've already discussed, I think these systems need to be aware of their environment. You know, it needs to know if it's about to run into something. Or, you know, a really interesting problem that I've talked to people about is if you go to a city like Chicago, if you've ever wandered along there, the streets that face the Great Lakes are very windy. And so you can wander along down the street parallel to, you know, to the lakefront, and there won't be any wind. And then, you know, as soon as you get out in that street, it's going to blow your airplane down or your UAV down the street. So you need to be aware that, oh, it's going to be windy in 50 feet. I better start cranking and preparing myself for that. So not only sensing what's happening, but maybe have some awareness of what may happen.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
I think there's a lot of fun stuff to do there.
No, you're right. You're right. I, you know, back to our work at GE, when we started to sensor up the industrial equipment, right, take from, this is an unkind characterization, but take from dumb equipment to smart equipment, to your point, you can imagine the equipment having a conversation, right? So it's not only monitoring cell health, but, you know, the networked context, right? And that becomes very dynamic and exciting. It's an exciting unlock, but you know, you, to your point, it's it's very difficult to try to retroactively kind of integrate those kinds of capabilities. It's better to design those systems with that intent in mind, really. So I'd love to switch over if we could. I know we have so much that we could cover, but you've done some work, some very important work. You mentioned the Paradise fires, and you've done some very important work in wildfire risk reduction research. And maybe if you could share with our listeners some of the work that you've done that could be helpful for communities in those types of emergency scenarios. And very dynamic scenarios as well, where a lot of unanticipated events have to be sensed or anticipated.
Are you interested specifically in how to reduce the risk to a community, reduce the risk to a forest, reduce the risk to the firefighters? What part of all that? I mean, there's a lot to this.
Just very broadly, share with our listeners some of the work that you've done in this area and what are some of the more important advancements in your work in that area.
Okay, so as we know from our discussion previously, I'm a bit of a computational physicist, and so the thing that I found very interesting is that there are some very amazing wildfire risk estimation tools, and they're computational physics based. There's a thing called IFTSS, IFTDSSS, which is a multi-agency supported wildfire risk tool, and maybe there's others. But as far as I can tell, it's really, really, really impressive and very capable. And I've used that to a significant degree to, for example, estimate the wildfire risk before and after the Paradise Fire. And that sort of tool will tell you if a forest is going to burn to first order, given some statistics like on the temperature and the weather and things like that. Very, very powerful tools. However, they don't tell you if a house is going to burn. So there gets to be an additional issue, which is, so a big fire is coming toward a city like Paradise. If this is pretty good at predicting if that's going to happen, then what happens when it gets into the city? And there's, you can start to think about fire breaks at the community level, start having, safety perimeters. Okay, that's one step. The next step is to actually make the houses safer. And there's at least two ways to do that. One is to just make the house less flammable. And so, for example, don't use stucco, don't have, flammable vegetation within 5 feet of your property. There's a whole long list of things that an organization called IBHS tends to lead. Then there's also, you need to keep the forest, particularly if you're living in what's called a WUI, wildfire urban interface, you need to keep the forest at maybe at some distance from your home. And that's a really pretty tricky thing, and it's an evolving thing, is that, you certainly don't want, bush or grasses up against your land. You probably don't want pine trees hanging over your house. And there's a long list of things like that. And just earlier this summer, I went to a prescribed burn, and I was able to watch all this stuff burn. And there's something called ladder fuels, which are these things that sort of hang off pine trees and things like that. They are literally explosive in their flammability. And so there's a lot that we could do to understand how to make our individual homes safer and to make the environment around them safer. So, and then I'll say one last thing and I'll stop. But I had the opportunity to work with two Stanford students that actually put together a very interesting gaming technology to help communities understand sort of what's going on. And so they all played roles. Oh, well, I'm the chief fire chief, or I'm a homeowner. And they were able to play each other's roles, and they start to develop more of a situational awareness of what needed to be done to protect their homes and their lives, their homes and their communities. So I'm sorry, that's a long thing, but, and then I'm actually working on trying to figure out if we can actually reduce the risk to particular homes using, publicly available data.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm just listening to you. I am thinking about that gamification, and those would be great educational tools for younger children as well. So they become a little bit more sensitized to their environments and and perhaps scenarios, how to react to scenarios that can evolve very quickly. So brilliant work. I also am mindful of the fact that a lot of these technologies, right? So at Stanford, you're seeing a lot of work regarding how the next generation of engineers really approach complex systems design. The gamification is a great example. What are some of the differences that you observe between how current students are thinking about aerospace or complex challenges versus maybe approaches that might have been very successful during your NASA career? Is there a distinction that you see evolving in the tools and the methodologies that students are starting to apply today, or are they sticking with what's tried and true?
Well, I saw this at NASA, and NASA was working on this, but I'm seeing it more as time evolves, or maybe also I'm seeing it more at NASA, and I'm seeing it even more at academia. But one of the most fundamental things, I think, is, and I think a common term is the whole concept of developing digital twins. And the whole concept of developing digital twins, even from concept. So there's a sequence of things you go through when you design a concept, preliminary, final, detailed design, and test. And I'm seeing students, for example, they'll go into something like Fusion 360, they'll design their system, they'll do some stress analysis. Oh, well, we need to do some fluid mechanics. Oh, well, let's pull up Fluid, ANSYS, OpenFOAM. And they'll rattle through all this, pretty quickly. I'm not sure that's the way it went 20 years ago. I'm pretty sure it isn't. But these students are quite capable of doing this. And I'm always very impressed. And I'm actually working with the flight club out there. I watch them a bit, but I watch these students and they're, oh, well, we're going to use this CFD code, or we're going to use this, stability analysis code. And then they write optimization scripts on top of these things. So these students are making extremely good use of, I'll just say, the digital twin capabilities that are evolving. And they're evolving from the fact that the computer is becoming more powerful. The algorithms are, to be honest, the languages and the C++ and things, they're very effective foundations. And then the AI, you throw all that together, it's quite impressive. And then if I had to say one other thing, I would say things are becoming much more interdisciplinary. And much as we discuss, Model T was basically a mechanical system. I've actually had some people at NASA say, well, we're hiring too many software engineers. Why do we need so many? It's just one of the many disciplines. I'm like, well, okay, so let's go out to your car. Let's yank your computer out. How do you think that's going to run right now? Well, you could yank. There was no computer in a Model T or Model A, but so, it's you really need to integrate both mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, computer science, and all that. So the students are very good at that now. I mean, they all take robotics classes and they learn, how to integrate mechanical and electrical systems.
Yeah. It's so exciting to see. And just the ability for them to take that and very quickly launch entrepreneurial initiatives is really exciting. And especially, I think Stanford does such a great job with that as well. So Lily, the Stanford Mechanical Engineering Program, to your point, is working on a couple of handfuls of global company projects annually. And really that cross-pollination of expertise and mentorship and really innovation is really exciting. So in your opinion, what does this model reveal about how we can scale knowledge transfer between academic research, industry innovation, and maybe even government mission requirements?
Well, we've talked about the fact that the diversity that you get by including them all is great. Mm-hmm. Maybe a flip side of that, our capstone program that I support, as well as some graduate work that I support, we work all the time we've worked with NASA, I think we're going to be working with Boeing, we work with the Woods Institute, we work with Stanford Medical, and sort of a collaborative theme that comes out is you need to have someone that has an application and something that they need. You know, an example we ran into is the Stanford Medical Organization Center identified that it was really hard to give shots to kids because you don't quite know where their veins are. Well, that's important because sometimes, you know, the medicine needs to go into your veins. So we, you know, they wanted us to help them design systems to make it easy to wear glasses so that you could see where the veins are on a human being. And I know there's a lot of technologies like that out there, but that's an example. And then just to give you another example, Boeing's identified, for example, that if a person's in a wheelchair and they're trying to get onto an airplane, fly in an airplane, get off the airplane, I mean, if you think about what they have to go through in terms of mobility or lack of mobility, you know, it's really a big problem. And that's a wonderful problem to hand over to, you know, an organization like Stanford, you know, to the students. I hope they get to decide if they want to work on this. But I think if you took four of these kinds of, you know, students and say, hey, what do we do? How do we make this better? How do we make it easier for people that are mobility, you know, have mobility challenges to go someplace, to go visit their relatives in a different city or country? So I don't know. Maybe I'm not answering your question, but I think there's just a lot of excitement there, which is, you know, industry, NASA, hey, what's your problem? What is it you need to have fixed? And then bring it to NASA and, or I'm sorry, bring it to Stanford. And of course, they need to help us understand the problem. And so we quite often ask for liaisons or, you know, somebody that, hey, what's the G-loading that this wheelchair needs to take? You know, things like that. And so they need to stay involved, but let the students have some, you know, do some design thinking on it.
No doubt. And there's really no limit to what you really discover with those kinds of diverse approaches to problem solving. But to your point, and you made this point right at the outset, just having clarity regarding the real problem that you are solving for and focusing on that and not necessarily so much how. And the students can work their magic, for sure. So the last question, but if we were to maybe look ahead at the convergence of maybe advanced scale mobility, space operations, autonomous systems, what excites you the most about the possibilities for creating more integrated, collaborative approaches to aerospace innovation over the next decade?
If I could, I'd like to offer a what.
Sure.
And then maybe think about how we could approach the what. So, what if we designed a transportation system where you could walk out the front door of your home and seamlessly, in a certain amount of time, you walk into the front door of your apartment in the caves of the moon? How do you do that? But I think if we could think about things a little bit more door to door, you know, for example, for transportation, and thinking about where the doors could possibly be, it opens up a lot of very interesting things to consider. So, for example, you know, you're probably going to go through multiple transportation systems. Those transportation systems need to be seamlessly integrated. You may want to have vehicles. I mean, classic example that aerospace engineers think about, well, okay, I might want to take off vertically. Oh, I got to go up to a certain altitude. Oh, I got to go into space. Oh, I need propellers to start with. Then I need a turbofan engine. Then I need a scramjet. Then I need a rocket. Okay. How do you do all that? So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think there's some really exciting what's. And I think if you could put groups together to approach those what's, that it would really energize this triad community that we're talking about. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's, I love that description. And there will be exponentially even more house to your point, right? If you got those groups together. So brilliant. Well, let's hope that they do more and more of that. But it's an exciting time to be in the innovation space. And we're deeply grateful for folks like you that are asking the what ifs and leading the hows and making sure that the next generation of engineers and glue searchers are thinking big and using all the tools at their disposal, which means leveraging that collaborative network, not in the least. So, Bill, thank you. Your journey has been just really inspiring and extraordinary. And I love that you're working with the next generation of engineers to get them vectored in the right direction, future leading innovation as well. So Bill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Grateful
for the conversation and grateful for your work. And for our listeners out there also, thank you for joining us today as we explored how data and reasoning fabrics can enable new forms of collaboration across government, industry, and academia in the aerospace sector, and really any sector. Please do check out this season's episodes as we continue examining how systems thinking can transform our approach to complex challenges from Earth orbit to Mars and beyond. So follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. And you can always learn more at shershawworks.com.